Our next case of the morning is number 044147, Illinois School District Agency against Pacific Insurance Company Limited and First State Management Group. Mr. Eaton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. We're here today because of an issue regarding an exclusion in a policy issued by the Appalachian Pacific. ISDA made a claim against the Pacific policy because they had been sued by an East Moline school district, and they had to defend their actions, which related to several counts. There was one for breach of contract, there was one for estoppel, there was one for waiver, and then eventually there was one for Section 155 under the Insurance Code of Illinois. It was the defense of that action by East Moline that we made the claim against our policy, which was an errors and omissions policy, which was issued by Pacific. Pacific took the position that there was an exclusion, and the exclusion was that any responsibilities or obligations assumed by contract by ISDA were not covered. We contend that the issue as it relates to estoppel, which is the only issue that is before this court, because the parties stipulated that as to the breach of contract claim and the 155 claim, there's no dispute. The breach of contract claim was not covered because that was an obligation that was assumed by ISDA and therefore not at issue. And the parties stipulated that the Section 155 defense was covered. So that agreement was before the judge, and the judge determined below that we would not be able to get our cost in fees for the defense of the estoppel claim because it was the judge's position that that was subject to the exclusion of the Pacific policy, that it was assumed by contract. And we respectfully disagree with
Mr.
that conclusion.
Yes. One of the arguments your opponents make is that the estoppel claim is really just a contract claim masquerading under a different word. And one of the reasons they see it that way is that they argue that the measure of damages that you would get from succeeding on the estoppel claim is really just the contract measure of damages. So I want to know whether, in your view, given the nature of the elements of the kind of estoppel claim you're trying to raise, that's true, or whether estoppel damages somehow look different from contract damages.
Your Honor, I believe there's a difference between the basis of liability and the remedy that ultimately is employed. The basis of liability in this case was based on our conduct, not based upon an assumption of that liability under the contract. The remedy, then, that the court relies upon is the contract that we did enter into that we originally said we will cover you and then withdrew that defense. That may govern the remedy, which means we would be liable for the remedy under the contract, not the liability. And I think there's a big difference there because there's two types of estoppels recognized in Illinois. There's contractual estoppel and equitable estoppel. And under the Nationwide versus Philos case that we cite and discuss, that is a situation whereby the party's conduct, not by contract, but by the party's conduct, where they create prejudice to the insured, then they may be liable under the policy, even if they were not liable otherwise.
Well, I mean, the Philos case and your argument makes me think that what you're essentially saying is that this is somehow a form of liability flowing from a gratuitous undertaking. You know, you went in there and, you know, as it turns out with hindsight, gratuitously undertook this defense, steps were taken, things happened, and then you pull the rug out from under East Moline because you discover, oh, you know, the policy doesn't really cover you after all because of pollution or whatever. And so they have actually been made worse off by your gratuitous undertaking.
Correct.
And Philo seems to be that kind of a case since there was no policy there. Here you're just in an exclusion, though. So does that model really work?
I believe it does because if you look at the claim by East Moline against ISDA, their claim was based on the fact that we did say we would cover it. We then pulled the rug out, and they claimed prejudice. And the prejudice that they claimed related to, well, you failed to pursue a medical malpractice claim, you failed to look at a secondary source of mercury. It's that prejudice from our conduct which defines equitable estoppel under Illinois law and under Philos, the same argument that they made in Philos. It's not a contract that assumed that liability.
Well, could I just go back to my damages point then? Because if you're going to focus on, let's say, failure to pursue medical malpractice, failure to look at alternative sources of the mercury, presumably one could explore those things, and if it turns out they made very little difference, maybe it wouldn't be a full measure of contract damages. It would just be the marginal difference between doing that and not, wouldn't it?
Well, what was found below and what triggered this dispute was that once it was determined that there was no contractual liability, which the court determined, the case went on for several years. The case, because there's so many cases here, is East Moline versus ISDA. The case continued for another couple of years on the issue of estoppel, because that was really the fact-based conduct that they were looking at, and that actually went to trial. The court held that there was no prejudice, therefore they could not prevail on their claim of equitable estoppel. It's those fees in defending that claim that we believe are covered by the Pacific policy. That's why we got an errors and omission policy, because ISDA on occasion or through its administrator may make a mistake. So we get this errors and omissions policy. What Pacific seems to be arguing here, Your Honor, is that any time there's a contract of insurance, that therefore the exclusion applies. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because they are providing a policy to the trustees of a self-insured plan. So they know there's going to be a policy of insurance almost always in dispute. Therefore, the exclusion would swallow up the entire policy. They've also, which I think is a very interesting point, they say that the Section 155 claim, which is for alleged vexatious delay in not paying out under the policy, is covered. Well, clearly that is extra contractual conduct which has created liability, the same as which equitable estoppel does. So it doesn't seem to me you can consistently say that the 155 claim is covered, but that the extra contractual liability, which is created by the theory of equitable estoppel, is not. Neither of them are assumed by contract. And in this case, the whole purpose of the errors and omissions policy was to cover ISDA for situations where they may make an error or omission in a situation where they have an insurance contract and they make mistakes, as was the case here. In looking at the pleadings, it's clear that East Moline is not making a claim as it relates to estoppel based upon an argument that it was covered. They have other counts where they say it's covered, contract, waiver, so they're seeking a declaration. But as to the estoppel claim, which is why we're here, under Illinois law, that's equitable estoppel, and that is a claim that should have been covered by Pacific, and it's a substantial amount in terms of the overall fees, because we, for 2 years, had to defend that claim, had to go to trial, and the court ultimately found in our favor. Briefly, too, because I see my light, there are other issues that are raised by Pacific, which were dealt with by Judge Scott in her opinion, and that relates to whether or not this proceeding against Martin Boyer should either have been properly stayed or there should be a set-off. Well, no money has been received by Martin Boyer, and I think Judge Scott was correct that if and when that occurs, she will decide whether or not that satisfies the judgment, and that would be in a post-judgment proceeding. Likewise, on late notice, which she also, in which, by the way, they did not appeal or cross-appeal because that would have affected any judgment being entered, she determined that there was proper notice. But I would argue they've waived that by not filing a cross-appeal, and the other issues they raised as covered versus non-covered, again, would go to the extent of the judgment that was entered. Therefore, it would have affected the amount, and they should have cross-appealed, and they didn't. But nevertheless, we feel Judge Scott was very scrupulous in deciding what was actually appropriate to award, and she only found on the basis of the 155 claim. So we'd respectfully request that this court reverse on the issue that the equitable estoppel claim was covered and remand it back to the judge to determine what that amount would be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. We'll hear now from Ms. Prendergast.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jean Prendergast, and I represent the defendant, Pacific Insurance. I wanted to touch on a few of the points that were raised by Mr. Eaton in his argument on behalf of the plaintiff. First of all, I believe that it is accurate when Judge Wood asked the question about the policy here and the exclusion and what is it that we're actually talking about in terms of the contract. I believe the question concerned what is the measure of damages. In the East Moline versus ISDA action, what would the measure of damages have been? What would they have been if East Moline had prevailed in that case? We would submit, and we do submit in our briefs, that Pacific would say that the measure of damages would be what was permissible under the policy in terms of the defense costs, and that ultimately in the Mansilla litigation there was a settlement that was paid.
But so, you know, I don't know why that would be true, because the elements of a promissory estoppel claim are somewhat different, and you've got to show reasonable reliance, and you've got to show, a change in position and so forth. And it is, in fact, at least theoretically the case that you don't necessarily get contract damages in a promissory estoppel case. Maybe sometimes they'll coincide, but they don't have to.
I think that, Your Honor, the answer to that is that looking at the allegations of the second amended complaint, well, there's an initial complaint, an amended complaint, and a second amended complaint in the East Moline action, which changed somewhat. But the essence of the allegations set forth with regard to the estoppel claim sound more in the nature of a contractual estoppel. There is an equitable argument based on prejudice. But if you look at the allegations closely, you'll see that it is very clear that what East Moline was attempting to recover was the measure, and have the measure of damages be what it was entitled to in the defense and settlement of the action.
But you know what? They might have actually wanted more, because the failure to pursue these other lines of inquiry might have prejudiced them, might have gone well beyond policy limits, whereas if it had been under the contract, there would have been a limit under the policy. I'm just not sure that we can read it that way. I mean, as I read the exclusion in the Pacific policy, it's very reasonably trying to draw a distinction between the errors and omissions, you know, negligence-based claims, other kinds of claims of that ilk, and contract claims. You're not a reinsurer. It's an errors and omissions policy. And so you've got to draw that line. But as Mr. Eden pointed out, it can't be that this exclusion applies any time a contract is relevant at all, because then you'd be taking a different position on the 155 claim. You wouldn't have a 155 claim without an insurance policy somewhere lurking in the background either.
Yes, and I understand your point, but I think that the distinction between the estoppel claim and the bad faith claim, the Section 155, is in the nature of the damages that are sought in that claim. The damages that are sought are statutory and above and beyond what is committed to in the contract. If we go back to the language of the policy, the language of the policy specifically states that it is not insuring for contractual undertakings that
sure.
The ISDA undertakes.
And I absolutely
undertakes.
Agree with that. I don't have any confusion about that at all, but what I'm looking at is the nature of an equitable estoppel claim. If you gratuitously undertake to do something for somebody and you do it badly, you might have to pay them much more money than you would have had to pay if there had been a contract. And so with the contract off the table, there's really no ceiling on the equitable estoppel damages.
Well,
you know, courts can award damages as they're entitled to be awarded.
Actually, I don't believe that issue was addressed in the East Moline case ultimately, because, of course, there was no finding of liability.
But that's right. But I'm just telling you, as a theoretical matter, I believe that's the case. If you won on an equitable estoppel ground, there's no reason to pull back in some contractual limitation on how much would be paid under a policy.
Certainly, but if we return to what was actually being sought by the plaintiff against ISDA and the way that the claim is pled in terms of pleading it very much like, as Judge Scott found, a contractual estoppel type claim.
Did they agree to cap liability as provided in the contract?
Do you mean in the East Moline versus
ISD? In the promissory estoppel case that went to trial.
The record, I think, is silent on that question.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, if we look at the other cases, such as Home versus 3i, the trucking case.
What about Philos? I wasn't very happy with your distinction of Philos.
Okay. My distinction of Philos is that in that case, I think that was truly a gratuitous undertaking, and there is a significant distinction in how you analyze the policy in the context of the facts of the complaint. In Philos, there was never an insuring agreement in place in the first instance. There was an error with regard to the time calculated, but there was no insuring agreement. And the relief that was ultimately given by the appellate court in Philos was, the court said that there may be something here. The court didn't say there was. It said there may be, and it reversed and remanded for additional proceedings to explore it further.
But why does it matter? I mean, if you had a policy as crystal clear as possible, let's say that this policy does not cover anything whatsoever about environmental liability, and some careless person forgot to look at that, and they defend an environment, they pay for a defense in an environmental liability case for a while. Why is that significantly different from Philos? Why isn't it just as gratuitous?
I think it is very significantly different because when you analyze an insurance company's duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, you first look at the insuring agreement to see whether it was even in effect. Was the policy period in place? Is there an actual agreement between these parties to cover the loss at issue? So you look
to
at the
cover the loss at issue, and then you discover this policy has nothing to do with environmental.
Well, the policy, though, actually in the loss provision, this was a covered loss under the definition provided in the policy. The issue was, and I think at the time, was an ambiguous, it was an open question. At least it was subject to some debate.
Well, then don't you construe it against you?
In terms of the absolute pollution exclusion?
No, I'm not talking about, I'm just trying to give you, I should maybe have used, this doesn't cover accidents on your way to the moon. I mean, anything. I'm just saying, if a policy is very, very clear that a certain set of risks are excluded, and the company pays no attention to that and pays for a defense of that set of excluded risks, my only question is, why isn't it just as gratuitous as in the no policy in effect situation?
I think that in this case, there was an open question about the absolute pollution exclusion and whether that did apply, which is a little bit different than the hypothetical that Your Honor presented.
I don't want to be on that at all because I'm trying to ask you something different. Never mind. It's all right.
Okay. If maybe to put it another way, I think that what you may be asking me is if the exclusion is so crystal clear, is that somehow different than Philos? And my answer would be yes, because there's still an insuring agreement in place. And in addition to that, my argument would be in this case there was an ambiguity as to coverage. It wasn't as crystal clear.
But we're not talking about it for this, because what we're talking about here is simply, on a promissory estoppel theory, does this exclusion cover promissory estoppel theories? And your argument is promissory estoppel is a contract theory. Because if promissory estoppel is a contract theory, then this would be an obligation or responsibility assumed by the insured under a contract. And if promissory estoppel is not a contract theory, then the exclusion doesn't cover it.
I think that my position is, and the position that we stated in the brief, is that the contractual estoppel or equitable estoppel, whatever the label is that you put on that remedy, the remedy that East Moline was seeking against ISDA, if you look at what the liability is, and this is where you go back to our exclusion, we're excluding liabilities assumed by contract. The measure of damages that East Moline was seeking to have its defense costs covered. It was seeking indemnification for the settlement that it engaged in the Mansilla action. So it was seeking those types of remedies in its complaint against the ISDA, for which we contend, based on the insuring agreement that was in existence, there is no coverage for that type of claim. In one other point that I just wanted to make briefly is with regard to the issue of prejudice and whether there was a failure to investigate the medical malpractice claims or a failure to look at additional sources for the mercury, all of those points come from the trial testimony, which we would submit under this court's decision in Reclue is inappropriate simply because when you're dealing with summary judgment, you have to look at what was before the district court at the time of summary judgment. I see that my time has expired, and I would respectfully request that Your Honors please affirm the district court's correct decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pendergast. Mr. Eaton has 1 minute.
Talk fast, Eaton.
I will, Judge. Actually, I only have two quick things to say as it relates to Philo's. I believe Philo's in our case are indistinguishable because in either event there was no coverage in place. Whether it was time of the loss or time of sale in Philo's where they said there was no policy that covered it, likewise here there was no policy that covered it because of the exclusion. Secondly, the only type of estoppel where prejudice is relevant is equitable estoppel. The Illinois Supreme Court said in the Eklo case, which we cited, that in contractual estoppel, if they've denied coverage where they should have provided it, then under those circumstances, you don't need to show prejudice. Here, there was a trial on prejudice we're trying to collect on. I have nothing further. If there's any questions, otherwise, we would reaffirm our request for relief to reverse and remand back to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Thank you to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.